Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In 1991, today's guest, Diane Ravitch, became Assistant Secretary of Education under George H.W. Bush. At the time, she championed national standards, vouchers, charter schools, and market-based alternatives to failing public schools. And then a decade later, we got No Child Left Behind, a bipartisan bill signed by George W. Bush. Diane Ravitch says she then realized that the real end game was not to reform public schools, but to privatize them. And she says as she saw that their strategies were failing, she jumped ship. Today, Diane Ravitch is one of the most prominent defenders of public education. She argues that Donald Trump and Betsy DeVos's proposed budget for the Department of Education is a boon for privatization and a disaster for public schools. She also argues that Democrats paved the way for Betsy DeVos's efforts to privatize public schools. So what's in store? And what is the best way to fight for public education? From 1991 to 1993, Diane Ravitch was Assistant Secretary of Education and Counselor to Secretary of Education Lamar Alexander in the administration of George H.W. Bush. She was responsible for the Office of Educational Research and Improvement in the U.S. Department of Education. Diane Ravitch is the author of a number of books. Her most recent is Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. And she joins us from New York. Hi, Diane. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thank you so much for calling.
Well, it's great to have you. For people who are not familiar with your story, can you just give us a thumbnail sketch of your journey in the education field and why you had a change of heart?
Well, to begin with, I went to public schools in Houston, Texas, K through 12. I then went to Wellesley College. And subsequently got a doctorate in history of education from Columbia University. I've been a historian of education since 1975. In 1991, I was invited to be part of the first Bush administration, as you mentioned, and I liked the idea. It sounded like a great idea of charter schools because initially they were supposed to reach out to the kids who had failed in public schools. They were supposed to pick up the dropouts and the kids who were unmotivated. And it sounded excellent. I, having served in the Bush administration, I then was active in three different conservative think tanks and was an advocate for standards, testing, accountability, charter schools, eventually even supported vouchers, at least in limited form. But about 2005, as I saw that No Child Left Behind, the Bush program, the Bush law, was actually creating a disaster in public schools, and that it offered charter schools, chartering schools, as a remedy to low scores, I realized that the end game was not to improve public schools, but to set them up for failure. Because we've always known, at least anyone who's paid attention has always known, that low test scores are associated with high poverty and racial segregation and under-resourcing of schools. So if we really wanted to reform schools, public schools, we would make sure that they were adequately resourced, and we would do something about child poverty, which is incredibly high in the U.S. The U.S. has higher child poverty than any other modern industrialized nation. And at this point, public schools are serving in many places, 40 to 50% of their kids are eligible for free or reduced price lunches because they're in a high poverty status. So this is the problem. The problem is income inequality. The problem is poverty. The problem is not bad schools. And yet the Bush administration, the second Bush administration, George W. Bush, and the Obama administration continue to pursue this policy of testing high stakes, closing public schools, opening charter schools. And now along comes the Trump administration to build on that legacy and to say public schools are no good. We want kids to go to religious schools and private schools with government money. And that's the DeVos plan. So it's a pretty awful scenario right now.
You say that the reform movements set up public schools for failure. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. The No Child Left Behind legislation made the ridiculous claim that by the year 2014, every child in America would be proficient in math and in reading. There's no country in the world that has 100% of its kids proficient in anything. And they were including kids with disabilities, kids with cognitive disabilities, kids who were homeless, hungry, etc. it was an impossible goal. And so by setting an impossible goal and saying that if you don't meet this goal and you're not on track to meet it, your school, first of all, you'll fire all the teachers and the principal, replace the entire staff. If you continue to not meet your goal of 100%, your school will be closed, and it will be available for a takeover by private corporations. So the amazing thing is that we still have public schools after the working out of No Child Left Behind, and then the Obama program called Race to the Top followed No Child Left Behind with this very punitive approach. We now have a new law called Every Student Succeeds Act. I mean, Every Student Succeeds is really just the same as No Child Left Behind. It's built on the absurd assumption that if you pass a federal law and say every student succeeds, that does it. You've just solved the problem of poverty and low academic performance. So the answer is really that schools were set up to fail by creating impossible goals. Almost no school in the country met the goal of 100% proficiency, especially when the proficiency bar was set very, very high.
Tell us a little bit about Betsy DeVos. She has not given any press conferences. According to the Poynter Institute, education reporters have been calling the Department of Education to find out more about her plans, but they're not getting any phone calls back. She hasn't really, in addition to no press conferences, she hasn't given any interviews.
Well, the thing to understand about Betsy DeVos is that she, first of all, she's a billionaire who was born into a family of billionaires, and she has no work experience, no experience whatsoever with public schools, and she has only one answer to every educational issue, which is choice. And if every parent could choose to send their child to a religious school, or private school, or to homeschooling, anything but public schools, that would be her goal. So she is an incredibly uninformed and ignorant woman in terms of education, because all she knows is choice as the answer. She's also a great believer in for-profit education, and she has rolled back regulations, for example, that protect college students from predatory organizations when students roll up tremendous debt, having attended a fraudulent an institution allegedly of higher education. So we have about $1 trillion in student debt right now, much of it attributed to these for-profit predatory institutions. And DeVos is rolling back the protections because she wants to protect the for-profit institutions, not the students. In terms of K-12 education, she has made it clear through her budget priorities that she wants to defund public schools and transfer funding to charter schools and voucher schools. And she's hopeful that more children will be going to religious schools, because the other thing, in addition to being a billionaire, is that she's a religious zealot.
The proposed budget for the Department of Education calls for a $13.5 billion cut, $10.6 billion in cuts from existing programs, and the diversion of $1.4 billion to charter schools and to vouchers for private and religious schools. Diane, since you've been involved in this education movement for so long, talk a little bit about school choice, that term, and how it has gained so much ground.
Well, it's an interesting term because many, many years ago, it was very much stigmatized. It was the expression associated with resistance to racial desegregation. Back at the time when the Brown decision was announced in 1954, the leaders of southern states that were entirely racially segregated used the term school choice to say, well, school choice is our answer. We'll let all the students pick which school they go to, and knowing that the white kids would go to the white schools and the black kids would go to the black schools. And so the Supreme Court repeatedly struck down what they call freedom of choice plans that came from the South, and said in order to comply with the Brown decision that required actual desegregation, the schools in the South had to have present numbers to show that they had desegregated, meaning that white and black students actually attended the same schools. So school choice was a stigmatized term because it was associated with segregation. Then in about 1990, various advocates for privatization began to use the term choice to say, why shouldn't everyone choose their own school regardless of whether it's public, private, or religious? And there was a very well-known book at that time by John Chubb and Terry Moe about school choice, in which they said that the problem that we have in American education is democracy. We should not have elected school boards. We should not have people making any decisions other than where do I want to send my child, which school do I want to send my child to. In fact, they said that school choice was a panacea. And so this movement for school choice, which actually could be traced back to a very influential essay by the libertarian economist Milton Friedman in 1955, where he made the argument for vouchers, and it didn't have any traction because 1955, of course, was the year after the Brown decision, and school choice meant segregation. But starting from about 1990 on, right-wingers glommed onto the idea of school choice as being a solution. But we now have a considerable body of evidence based on studies of voucher programs in the states that vouchers actually retard student progress. Kids who transfer from low-performing schools to voucher schools do worse when they enter voucher schools.
Can you elaborate on that? In the New York Review of Books, you wrote a piece called The Demolition of American Education, and you looked at Milwaukee, for example. Milwaukee opened charter schools and a voucher program for poor children back in 1990, and it now has three competing sectors: public schools, charter schools, and voucher schools. You write that the latter two sectors, charter schools and voucher schools, get to choose their students and prefer to avoid students with profound disabilities or who are in the process of learning English, whereas the public schools are required to take everyone. You write that nonetheless, there is little, if any, difference in test results among the three sectors, and Milwaukee is one of the lowest performing urban districts in the nation on the federal tests, and you say that there's no rising tide there.
Yes, that's exactly right. If you wanted, if anyone wanted to see the test case for the effect of charters and vouchers, they would look to Milwaukee, because it is the one city that has had charters and vouchers since about 1990. So that's 27 years. That's more than two generations of children. And there's no evidence whatever that kids do better in charters or vouchers. And there's now more and more evidence that they do worse in voucher schools, because there have now been studies in Indiana, Louisiana, Ohio, and also the District of Columbia, showing that the kids who got vouchers actually saw their scores go down. And that means that kids are being harmed. Now, why would that be? It's because when kids go to schools that are not required to have certified teachers, as many voucher schools, vouchers are not, private schools don't have to have certified teachers. Many of the religious schools that participate don't have certified teachers. They have uncertified people who have, maybe they've been teaching for years, but frankly, they're really not equipped as certified teachers are. And so if you send kids to schools that don't have certified teachers, you're not going to get better results.
In a place like Milwaukee, as you report, which has one of the lowest performing urban districts in the nation, what changes would you like to see?
Well, a few years ago, I wrote an article and said, wouldn't it be wonderful if instead of supporting three sectors, the leaders of Milwaukee said, we've tried vouchers, it didn't work. We've tried charters, they didn't work. We're seeing the destruction of public education. Public schools in Milwaukee have far more students with disabilities than either the charter schools or the voucher schools. What if we put our efforts together and had one sector, had public school sector where we could hold them accountable for performance and make sure that every child's need was met? Instead, we have the one sector, public schools, that has to accept everyone who applies, no matter what time of year it is, no matter what their disability or condition, and two sectors that are able to kick kids out that they don't want or exclude kids that they don't want. And there's something bizarre about that. It's as though we're going back to the before the Brown decision, where some schools were for black kids, some schools were for white kids. Now we have really a public sector and a non-public sector, and the non-public sector chooses its students, and the public sector is required to take everyone, and that's fundamentally unfair.
Today we are speaking with education historian Diane Ravitch. She is the author of a number of books. Her most recent is Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and The Danger to America's Public Schools. Diane Ravitch became Assistant Secretary of Education under George H.W. Bush, and at that time she was a champion of things like vouchers, charter schools, and market-based alternatives. But then she realized that the real end game was not to reform public schools, but to privatize them. She saw that these strategies were failing, and she decided to leave that movement. Today, she's one of the most prominent defenders of public education. And if you have any questions or comments for Diane Ravitch, we do so many shows about these issues. If you have any stories to share, if you've seen changes in your district, we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on what Betsy DeVos and the Trump administration has in store for public education? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also tweet us at Your Call Radio. Diane, for people who are not familiar with how these different models work, can you talk about the differences between, for example, the for-profit charters and then the public school charters, and then also the charter schools that specifically reach out to poor kids of color?
Well, there are the thing to recognize is, first of all, vouchers are private schools. They're religious schools. Most are religious schools, the overwhelming majority. So when Betsy DeVos advocates for vouchers, or when governors and red states advocate for education savings accounts or tax credits, they're really talking about allowing parents to send their kids to religious schools. That's where the money is going. That's taxpayers allowing money to flow to religious schools that are completely unaccountable to the public.
And on that point, who runs these religious schools?
They're in the South. They're mainly fundamentalist schools, in many states they're mostly Catholic schools, but these are schools that are free to choose the students they want. So students can get a voucher and apply, but the school doesn't have to accept them, which means there's a basic difference with public schools, because public schools have to enroll everyone who applies. They may not get into the public school that they want to go to, but they have to be cared for. Whereas if it's a voucher school, and it's usually a religious school, they can say no. In our school, we don't accept children of a different religion, or we don't accept children with disabilities because we don't have the facilities for them, or we don't accept children who are gay or children of gay parents. You know, all of these things are possible in the private sector. They're not permitted in the public sector. When you're in the public sector, there are federal laws that apply. And so the voucher schools that DeVos wants are not covered by, for example, the federal laws that protect children with disabilities. So they're free to exclude those children or not to provide services for them. Now, the charters are a more complicated issue because most states call them public charter schools. Actually, they are not public schools at all. They're privately managed schools. Mm-hmm. There are a few states that allow districts to create charters. Virginia is one of those states in which they have 9 charters for the whole state, and they are controlled by the local school districts. But in most states, the charters are run by private corporations, and they lobby for more money, and they are private schools that are publicly funded.
Can you talk a little bit more about that? Because we're doing a show in a couple weeks about this new documentary called STEP, and it's about this public charter school in Baltimore attended by black girls in Baltimore. And I was surprised to learn that one of the corporate sponsors for that school is Northrop Grumman.
Well, charter schools in many cases go into inner city communities and select the best qualified students. So they will serve children of color, but only the ones they want to serve. And so we have some very successful charter schools, but they do not enroll children with disabilities. Those that have disabilities are very mild disabilities, like a learning disability, like needing help learning to speak correctly, or a hearing problem that needs a hearing aid. But the children who have cognitive disabilities, the kids who have severe disabilities, are not wanted. So the secret of success for the charter schools that enroll black and Hispanic kids is, first of all, they choose the students they want, they kick out the students they don't want, and when you see claims like we have a 100% graduation rate or a 100% college acceptance rate, you have to look more closely at the data, because those charters always have very high attrition rates. And so when you see a listing, for example, from U.S. News and World Report or anywhere else that says the best school in the country is X charter school, that will be a school that has very high attrition, where they've accepted, say, 200 kids, and then only 40 of them survive to graduate, and they say, look, 100% graduated. Well, most of them have disappeared before they reach 12th grade.
Hmm.
So if you select your students carefully, if you don't allow students who are English language learners, if you don't allow kids with cognitive disabilities, then you can have a very successful school and get high test scores. And that's usually the only thing people look at when they compare charters and public schools. Charters are almost never public schools. And I would go so far as to say they are never public schools. They are contract schools. They're contracted out to private corporations that are not transparent about their finances and not transparent about academic program. And I think the best evidence of this is that the NAACP last fall issued a resolution, or approved a resolution, calling for moratorium on new charters, specifically because the charters are parasites. They are doing all the things that I described, choosing the students they want, kicking out the students they don't want, and they're not neither transparent nor accountable. So when you have the nation's oldest civil rights organization saying we need a moratorium on new charters until they follow the same laws and the same rules as public schools, and then the organization Black Lives Matters also endorsed a resolution saying the same thing, we need a moratorium on new charters because the charters are operating like private corporations in the public sphere.
There was a piece in the Washington Post by Valerie Strauss, Why Opening a Charter School is Like Opening Your Own Business. And she included another piece by Carol Burris, and she writes, opening a charter is akin to opening your own business, but the cost and risk are fully funded by the taxpayers. In most states, taxpayer dollars provide the initial investment. This is an odd business model in which the corporation gets income for every customer who walks through the door, regardless of the individual ability to pay. And if the business fails, owners are not out a dime, but the customers, who are in this case children, are stranded.
Right. And that's a huge problem. All the risk is with taxpayer dollars, and I don't think that taxpayers understand. Now, the reason that the charters have been able to get this kind of wonderful deal in which states like, Michigan, for example, where Betsy DeVos comes from, more than 80% of the charter schools in Michigan operate for profit. Now, that's unusual. There's no other state in the country where most of the charter schools operate for profit. The charter schools do not perform as well in Michigan as the public schools, but because of the DeVos money, she has bought enough legislators, just as she's bought a lot of people in Congress, with very huge contributions. Michigan is a very choice-crazy state, and over the past 15 years, they've seen their standing on national tests drop, dramatically, the more they have advocated for choice. She tried to get vouchers in Michigan, but the voters turned it down the year 2000 by a vote of 69-31%. So the public doesn't want all this Wild West approach to education. They'd rather have well-funded public schools in their district. But instead, Michigan is a place for voracious charter businesses. In Florida, where there are also for-profit charters, charters come and go every year. The state gives them a grant to prepare to open. Some of them never open. They're called ghost charters. They simply never open. They take the money and disappear. Others open, operate for a while, and then they disappear too, leaving the kids stranded, sometimes in mid-year. This is an insane way to provide education.
Diane, before we go to break, religious schools aside, what is the end game for this charter movement? Is it all about money for the ones that you're describing?
You have to understand that the charter movement has been heavily funded, as well as vouchers, by very extreme right-wing forces like the Koch brothers, and by right-wingers in many, many states. I mean, in almost every state, there's a right-wing billionaire, maybe more than one, pushing the charter movement. Some of the billionaires pushing the charter movement are not right-wingers, like Bill Gates and Eli Broden in Los Angeles, and yet they are playing the same game. The Walton Family Foundation, which owns the Walmart stores, has funded one out of every four charters in America, and they hate unions, and they want to destroy public education. It's about trying to impose privatization and free market onto what was once one of our premier democratic institutions.
Today we're speaking with education historian Diane Ravitch, who was involved in the corporate reform movement. She says when she realized that the real end game was not to reform public schools, but to privatize them, she jumped ship. And today she's one of the most prominent defenders of public education. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. And you can post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at yourcallradio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will have a conversation about tenant rights. In last November's election, a number of Bay Area cities passed or strengthened rent control laws. There's a bill at the state level that would extend tenant protections to people who rent single-family homes. So how has the housing crisis revitalized the renters' rights movement? That's tomorrow. And then on Thursday, we'll talk about Donald Trump's travel ban. Friday, it's our media roundtable. Today, we are talking about the current state of public education with education historian Diane Ravitch. She was once involved in the corporate reform movement. She was Assistant Secretary of Education under George H.W. Bush. But she says when she realized that the real end game was not to make public schools better, but to privatize them, she left the movement. And today she's one of the most prominent defenders of public education. Her latest book is Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. And if you'd like to join us, we'd love to hear from you. California has more charter schools and charter school students than any other state. So if you have a child who goes to a charter school, if you're involved in a charter school, we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on Diane Ravitch's arguments, and what do you think about all of the studies that have been coming out? And then if you have a broader question about the state of public education, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also tweet us at Your Call Radio. Let's hear from Catherine in San Francisco. Hi, Catherine. Welcome to the show.
Hi. It's Kathleen.
Oh, hi, Kathleen. Sorry about that.
That's okay. First of all, I want to thank Diane Ravitch. She has been a breath of fresh air. When I was in the school teaching like 12 years ago and seeing the writing on the wall about vouchers, seeing her come to the fore, reading her articles, I was just so inspired and glad that she's out there. So thank you, Diane. And I want to just make a mention of there's so many difficulties that public school teachers have to deal with, but because of having to take all of the children with disabilities and the vouchers and private schools don't, and charter schools. One of the things that's happened, there are good sides of it, but this whole concept of mainstreaming where children and their parents insist on it and have the right to insist on it that they go be mainstreamed into regular classrooms even when they have severe cognitive and behavioral disabilities, which often go together. And what happens is then the teachers in a regular classroom have to take these kids in, design special lesson plans for them. They get them special easy tests. They very often have, because there's a lot of money in special ed, they often have their own aide with them, working with them all the time. And I saw what this did to the regular students with the disruptions in class from the behavioral stuff and with having to spend all the time dealing with, and the teachers who are already overworked, having to design special programs. And the parents have the power, and were very tyrannical often, about threatening lawsuits if they didn't get their kids in a private, or if they thought that the teacher wasn't doing enough for them. Mm-hmm. It was like a kind. It just was kind of a sad thing to watch, especially because what it burden on the teachers and the other students whose education was curtailed, I think, by having that, and especially in light of the fact that we had excellent special ed teachers, but the parents didn't, I mean, really good ones, and they did really well with the kids, and they learned much more in those classes, but they ended up, you know, wanting to mainstream them, and I just see that as another burden on the public schools and the public school teachers. That's all I want to say.
All right, Kathleen, Diane Ravitch?
I think that it's a mistake to just say if a parent wants it, they should have it. I think that there has to be discretion on the part of both teachers and principals about when it's appropriate to mainstream a child with disabilities and when it is not. And you're quite correct that there are the public schools have many teachers who are well trained in the needs of children with disabilities, and those teachers should be called upon and use their judgment as well.
Thank you for calling, Kathleen. Diane, what about federal laws? Do charter schools, these private charter schools, have to comply with federal laws?
Well, they're exempt from many of the laws. For example, everyone knows, because there have been reports again and again, that charter schools are not taking their fair share of students with disabilities. And yet, and they'll say, we can't provide for them. Well, they're supposed to, if they're public schools, they must provide for them. So clearly, they're exempt from that federal law, and that's the most, as Kathleen said, that is one of the most difficult and onerous of the federal mandates, and yet charters are not meeting that mandate. They simply say, well, we can't do it, but public schools can't say we can't do it. They must do it.
How is this allowed?
You got me. I don't know. I mean, the charter lobby has been incredibly powerful in Washington as well as in the states, and they have created this special category of schools that are allowed to receive public funding without public accountability. They have said that the purpose of charter schools is that they can experiment. Well, I don't know of a single innovation that has come from the charter sector in the 27 years or so that we've had charter schools. Having a longer school day, public schools can do that. Hiring uncertified teachers, not a very good innovation. Excluding kids with disabilities and excluding kids who don't speak English, that's not an innovation that public schools can use or should use. So, yeah, there are a lot. Part of what they do is to say, when we created the charter schools, they are not subject to the same state laws. They're certainly not subject to the civil rights laws. They're not subject to the laws governing disabilities.
Let's go next to Tat in San Francisco. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hi. What you're talking about as far as public schools is nothing new. I'm 64 years old. When I went to school in the 50s and 60s, there was two tracks, the ones going to college and the ones who would just go to the factories. And I had teachers who told the, if you're not going to learn, why don't you just quit school and leave some room for somebody who does want to learn. Or a teacher who sat there and read his newspaper. And my wife, who went through the New York school system, was considered mentally retarded because she was deaf. She had a high school diploma that wasn't worth the paper it was written on. And she went to what was then called the special classes. So what you're talking about is nothing new. Nothing has improved in 50 years.
Diane, you've been involved in the movement for decades. What do you think about Tat's comment?
Well, I think the schools have gotten much, much better in the past 50 years. And if you want the evidence of it, I assembled it in my book, Reign of Error. I have the test scores for the last 50 years, the international test scores for the last 50 years. The dropout rates have declined dramatically, although I think a lot of that is due to what's called credit recovery, where kids are being pushed through to graduate just to meet the numbers. What has been particularly bad about the past 20 years starts with George W. Bush and No Child Left Behind, which is that everything is test scores, and so everybody is incentivized to raise test scores whether the kids are learning anything or not, and the schools have been standardized, and there was never in this country the belief that the federal government should run the public schools of America, and yet that is what has happened since the passage of that law in January of 2000. It was passed in the fall of 2001, signed into law in 2002, so it's been 15 years of standardization, and it's not the way to have better education.
And now you have school districts across the country that are experiencing massive budget cuts. And the Washington Post has a piece in May about how scores of districts in Oklahoma are now going down to just 4 days a week. Foreign language classes are disappearing. Class sizes are ballooning. They report that of 513 school districts in Oklahoma, 96 have lopped Fridays or Mondays off of their schedules. They're gone. This is triple the number in 2015, four times as many in 2013, and an additional 44 districts are considering cutting instructional days by moving to a four-day week.
I think that all of this is just evidence of a national disinvestment in education. And charter schools are not the answer. Vouchers are not the answer. I think the reason we're talking about school choice as a remedy is that it's a way of avoiding the elephant in the room. The elephant in the room is disinvestment in education. And when you consider, for example, that Washington State has no state income tax, and there are 13 billionaires, including Bill Gates in Washington State, who don't pay a dime of state taxes. And so they have been promoting charter schools as an answer. Well, that's not an answer. The schools need to be adequately funded, and they can't be adequately funded when the richest people in the state don't pay state taxes. But this is true across the country. If you ask what's behind the privatization movement, it's about very, very wealthy people supporting an organization called the American Legislative Exchange Council. It's known familiarly as ALEC. ALEC is for deregulation. It's for deregulation of guns, deregulation of environment, deregulation of and privatization of schools, and the destruction of public services. And it's all about cutting taxes for very wealthy corporations and individuals. That's what's behind all of this.
Can you elaborate on that more? Because this Washington Post piece says that states across the country are now looking to implement four-day school weeks. And for the parents who have jobs 5 days a week and don't have any alternative, they actually have to pay the school to allow the child to go to school on Fridays or Mondays.
Well, this is, again, evidence of we as a nation are not willing to pay the cost of educating the next generation. And we will pay the cost ultimately in having a poorly educated generation of young people entering the workforce. Now, education is about a lot more than workforce preparation. It's about citizenship. And you only have to think about the last election and the disastrous result, in my opinion, to realize that we paid a price for not teaching civics. We paid a price for not teaching history. We paid a price for not teaching the arts. And I believe that every school should have the resources. I mean, I went to public school in Texas in the 1950s, and we had the arts. We had physical education. We had recess. All of these things are being sacrificed in order to make time, more time for testing and less time for all the things that are not tested.
Today, we're speaking with education historian Diane Ravitch. She was once a proponent of things like charters and vouchers, but then she says she realized the real end game was not to improve public schools, but to privatize them. So she left that movement, and now she's one of the most prominent defenders of public education. Her most recent book is called Reign of Error. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. What are your thoughts on this education crisis that we're in? If you send your child to a charter school, what do you think about vouchers? We'd love to hear from you. If you work in education, we'd love to hear from you. You can also tweet at Your Call Radio. Let's go to Roberta in San Leandro. Hi, Roberta. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Rose. Thank you. I just wanted to say that it seems to me, from listening, the analysis is that the very wealthy people in our country are investing in these for-profit charters and voucher schools in order to have even more of our taxpayer dollars put into their pockets. I mean, it's outrageous.
Diane, do you want to comment?
Yes. There was a time where I had great hope that Governor Jerry Brown would be a champion of public education, but he's not. He was asked to sign a bill passed by the California legislature to ban for-profit schools, which have been really, they're horrible schools. I mean, the biggest and the most rapacious of them is an online charter school called K-12, which gets horrible results but makes a lot of money. and Governor Brown vetoed the effort to block those schools. He said that he didn't know of any evidence that there was anything wrong with for-profit schools. So California is one of the few states that does allow for-profit schools. I mean, unfortunately, there are a lot of states that ban for-profit schools, but then the schools open up as nonprofit and are run by a for-profit organization. In Ohio, they ban for-profit schools, and most of their charter schools are run by for-profit management companies.
You have a piece in the New Republic called Don't Like Betsy DeVos, Blame the Democrats. And you write that 30 years ago, there was a sharp difference between Republicans and Democrats on education. Republicans wanted choice, testing, and accountability. Democrats wanted equitable funding for needy districts and highly trained teachers. You write that in 1989, that's when the lines began to blur. Bill Clinton drafted a bipartisan set of national goals for the year 2000, and the benchmark would realize by creating for the very first time national achievement standards and tests. He ran on that issue and then passed those goals. You also write that when Obama took office in 2009, educators hoped that he would return the party to its public school roots, but that didn't happen. He instead embraced a race to the top.
Yes, this is correct. And it's correct that I wrote those things, and I believe that all of those statements are verifiable. Race to the top was really no different. The Obama program was no different from the George W. Bush program. And the George W. Bush program was written primarily to make public schools look bad by setting impossible goals, as I said earlier. And we continue to believe in this idea that if everybody has exactly the same curriculum, that everybody will end up at exactly the same place. That's what's behind the Common Core standards, which have been adopted in California. And we know that it's not true. We now have enough experience with the Common Core standards to say that the kids who are already advantaged will do fine, and the kids who are disadvantaged will do worse. And so what the Common Core standards are doing is increasing the achievement gaps between those at the top and those at the bottom. And they've turned out to be incredibly unpopular. There are Democrats who oppose them, there are parents who are fighting them, and they're of both parties. But the very idea that standards and testing will create equity is a nonsensical idea. The definition of a test is that it separates people out. Now, it's true that with a driver's test, almost everyone can pass a driver's test, but a test in school is designed to have a top and a bottom, and that means that kids will be separated out based on ability or based on their knowledge. But what the best predictor of test results, standardized test results, is not IQ, it's family income. So we have in place a measure that will always disadvantage the poorest kids, because that's the nature of the measure.
You also write that when you look at the Wall Street money that is being funneled into this cause, into the charter movement, it's going to both Republicans and Democrats. You say that among its favorites have been sharp Betsy DeVos critics, including George Miller, Michael Bennett, and Cory Booker. Conservative funders like the Walton Foundation give generously to charter schools and liberal think tanks like the Center for American Progress. Can you talk about that?
It's always a good rule when trying to look at this issue to follow the money. And I blog every day, and in my blog I'm constantly pursuing where's the money coming from. And so we found that in New York State, which is a blue state like California, and in California, which is obviously a blue state, the money for charters is coming in the lobby, the California Charter School Association. In New York, it's called Families for Excellent Schools. The money is billionaire money. It's not coming from liberal organizations. It's coming from billionaires who want privatization. Massachusetts, another blue state, had a referendum on charters last fall. And the news of what happened in Massachusetts was overshadowed, obviously, by the national election. But there was a pitch battle about something called Question 2, whether to expand the number of charter schools allowed in Massachusetts. Millions and millions of dollars came into the state of Massachusetts to push new charters. And it was coming from out of state, from people like the Waltons in Arkansas, Mayor Bloomberg in New York City, all of these billionaires who had a great interest in expanding the number of charter schools. The union in Massachusetts, which is very strong, fought that successfully, and it was defeated overwhelmingly. Like, the vote was something like 62-38 statewide, and the only districts that voted for it were wealthy districts that thought, well, we'll never have a charter school. But the districts that already had a charter school voted heavily against it because they knew that the money for the charters would come out of their district budget, and they didn't see any virtue in having other charter schools that would further deplete the district budget.
What do you think about how the media covers these issues, Diane? There was a piece in the Washington Post a couple weeks ago called Diane Ravitch, Why is PBS Running This Education Documentary? And Valerie Strauss writes that if you go to the website of the Cato Institute, the libertarian think tank in Washington that believes in privatizing the public education system, you'll learn about a three-part documentary called School Inc. It's narrated by the late director of the organization's Center for Educational Freedom. And you, in this piece, you write a response to this documentary, and you say that, you know, over the past couple of decades, the movement to transfer public money to private organizations has expanded rapidly, and you watched this documentary twice, preparing to be interviewed by a channel in New York. Tell us about this documentary.
Well, I was quite shocked that PBS would run a three-hour documentary that was funded by four right-wing libertarian foundations. And I looked at their websites, and none of them had ever given, as far as I could tell, any money to public education. They had only supported vouchers and school choice. And so the documentary reflected the funders, which was that it was one-sided, and that it claimed that privatization was innovation and that public schools were obsolete. And this was ridiculous because there was nothing innovative about any of the private schools that he showcased. So he showed, for example, the American Indian Model Charter Schools in Oakland, where there's not a single American. I think there may be one American Indian left in the charter school. Most of the kids there are Asian American, even though Oakland is only 12% Asian American. And he said, well, the public schools tried to close down this wonderful charter school with high scores in Oakland, and alleging that the founder had committed financial improprieties. What they should have added in post-production was that the founder has actually been indicted for having money laundering. He's under an indictment by the federal government on six different counts of money laundering and theft, and there was an effort to close down the school, but the school retained its charter. It still exists, and it's one of these no-excuses schools where children are treated and disciplined in what I consider very brutal fashions.
Valerie Strauss, education reporter with the Washington Post, reached out to PBS, and over an email, a spokesman said that the network stations, quote, offer programs that reflect diverse viewpoints and promote civil dialogue, and that the documentary School Inc. is an independent production that reflects the personal viewpoint of the series creator Andrew Coulson. What's your response to that?
Well, I think what they're saying is that they're offering one-sided, partisan, biased, and inaccurate information with no debate and no discussion. And I think of PBS the way Bill Moyers said it. Bill Moyers was recently interviewed, and he said PBS is involved in the search for truth. This documentary was not about the search for truth. It was propaganda and a hit piece on public education, and I was very disappointed to see PBS sponsoring it, because I don't know of any other examples where they've allowed right-wing foundations to simply take over, buy their airspace, which is what they did in that example.
Diane, we have about 5 minutes left. As you said, California has more charters and charter school students than any other state. A lot of people send their kids to charter schools. They like their charter schools. We have done shows, we've seen documentaries where at certain charter schools they have incredible resources. They're able to spend a lot of time with the kids who need it most. You know, very dedicated teachers, counselors, dance class instructors work for these schools. What would you say to them?
Well, I would say to them that they're sending their kids to private schools at public expense. And I think that where we're heading, and California is heading, is allowing a private sector to be publicly funded. And that's fundamentally unfair, because every dollar that goes to their school is taken away from a public school that enrolls kids that will not be accepted in the charter. And I think that that's fundamentally at odds with democracy, and that every public school should have the resources that their charter school has. The other thing about California is that the California Charter Schools Association is one of the most powerful lobbies, if not the most powerful lobby in the state of California. They have billionaires like Reed Hastings and Eli Broad funding them. Richard Reardon, who used to be the mayor of L.A., is also funding them. And so they get whatever they want, more or less, from the state. Anyone can open a charter school in California. California has probably had more charter scandals than any other state in the country, with the possible exception of Michigan, Betsy DeVos's state. California lets anyone open a school, and then later on they catch them when they're stealing. That's not a way to run public education, because charter schools are not public schools. This is private schools for selected students diverting public dollars.
You mentioned,
and if they feel okay with that, then, you know, this is a choice they make. But I think that every public school should be under the supervision of a school district.
You mentioned Reed Hastings. He's the CEO of Netflix, and
right,
they're doing so well these days. Last year, he announced that he was creating a $100 million foundation for education, and he's a huge proponent of charter schools.
Yes, well, he gave $5 million to the California Charter Schools Association recently, and he spoke to a national organization of charter schools saying he looked forward to the day when there would be no more elected school boards and where every school would be a charter school run privately. What if that day comes, then you'll see schools that are privileged schools that are charter schools, and the few remaining public schools will be for the kids that no one else wants. What Reed Hastings is about is the destruction of public education, and I think he's in bed with ALEC, with the Waltons, and with the most right-wing ideologues in the country.
Yeah, and he got involved in an L.A. school board election earlier this year. It actually got national attention because so much money was poured into it.
That was the most expensive school board race in American history. I forget whether it was $18 million, $20 million, something like that. Never has a school board race attracted that kind of money.
Wow.
And just as the state race in Massachusetts over charters attracted something like $34 million, it's all about billionaires having fun with their money, and it's just unfortunate. Somebody should sit down and give Reed Hastings a civics lesson.
Diane, we have about a minute left. For people who want to support public schools and believe in public education, what would you say to them?
Well, I'd say that they should join an organization that is fighting to make public schools better. I happen to run one. I don't get any money from it. It's called the Network for Public Education. We have over 400,000 members, and we work to defend and support and improve public education across the country. And we try to network people with organizations in their own states. So join the Network for Public Education, and we'll direct you to the organizations in California and in every state that are working to improve public education and to save it from privatization.
Education historian Diane Ravitch once championed vouchers and charter schools. And then she says when she realized that the real end game was not to reform public schools, but to privatize them, she became one of the country's most prominent advocates for public education. Her most recent book is Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. Diane, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation about tenants' rights. In last November's election, a number of Bay Area cities passed or strengthened rent control laws. A California state bill would extend tenant protections to people who rent single-family homes. And then in San Francisco, supervisors are debating the best way to curb fraudulent owner move-in evictions. How has the housing crisis revitalized the renters' rights movement? That is tomorrow at 10. Your Call is produced here at KALW. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Kevin Vance was our studio engineer. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.